Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be European and live in the UK. I'm Carola Boone.
And I'm Richard McCarthy.
And I'm back in the UK.
Hurrah. And but not yet wearing headphones in bed.
No. Well, if you listen to the outtakes, you will know what that is about. Right. We're on our last chapter of the political guidelines of Ursula von der Leyen's vision for Europe over the next 5 years. And it's a big one, isn't it?
Well, it's covering most things, I suppose, isn't it? It's a kind of a go over everything.
Possibly, but I think it's focusing on, it's titled A New Push for European Democracy, and it's focusing on some big themes.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, that's right. Beg your pardon. Maybe you'll cut that out.
I can't cut your voice. I missed your voice for the last 6 weeks. Do you want to just read the first paragraph?
Okay. I want Europe to strive for more in nurturing, protecting and strengthening our democracy.
And of course, you know, what does it mean to protect our democracy? We've just celebrated our Hexity non-Brexit day.
Yeah, that's right. Still being in Europe.
By the skin of our teeth. And we had long discussions amongst us whether it was better to aim for a people's vote or whether it was better to go for a general election. And of course, you know, the parliament finally managed to go for a general election. So we're in election mode and we feel we're still hanging by the tips of our fingers because now the question of Brexit will be decided on the basis of a general election, which is admittedly not the best way to decide one question, to have a general election. As Caroline Lucas actually mentioned, she said, you know, the key is in the name. It's called general election.
Absolutely. And it's only maybe will be decided by a general election. So it would be decided by a general election if the Conservatives get a majority or if the Lib Dems get a majority.
Yeah.
Neither of which seems likely.
Or there will be a coalition.
Yeah, and if there's coalition, then it won't be decided.
Yeah.
Because
and then
Labour would be a big factor, and Labour have said, no, we want to go for a different agreement and then vote on things.
It's the first election in my memory of living here in the UK where I don't know who to vote for. And I know you're standing as a Green candidate.
Mm-hmm.
In some constituencies, the Greens have made agreement to support each other, so to decide where they stand and where they don't stand in order to maximise the Remain vote.
Who have, sorry, Remainers have some, yes, a few.
The Lib Dems, the Greens, the Plaid Cymru.
Yeah, not very many.
Yeah, and of course, you know, then the question is, do I vote Green? Because the general election, we need a Green voice in Parliament, but that might split the vote. Do I vote Labour? And I've always voted Green. Do I vote Labour, which has promised a people's vote, but only after trying a different type of withdrawal agreement?
Mm-hmm.
Do I vote Lib Dems, who said revoke, which I'm, you know, that's probably the closest to my stance. But the Lib Dems and their policies are the most furthest
away. Very conservative. Because they've been backing the Conservatives all the time in the last 10 years.
So in terms of the policies, you know, the closest are the Greens to me, but then the Labour and then the Lib Dems. But it feels like I'm forced to vote Lib Dems to safeguard
I think it's very much constituency by constituency. So in this constituency, for example, where we are, I believe the Lib Dems polled about 3,500 votes.
I've got the numbers here if you want to just, you know, because...
Okay, go ahead.
So in the 2017 election...
Yeah, which was also a weird election.
Does that count for now? Now it's a completely different type of election. But the Conservatives won with 31,000 and a bit votes, then Labour with 19,000, Lib Dems with 2,900, UKIP 1,200, and Greens 999. But of course, the Greens, as we know...
The candidate came out and wrote a letter and said, go with the Lib Dems.
Yeah, so he supported, to not split the vote, he supported one of the Remain parties.
But this, if you remember, the 2017... vote was very, everything became all about Conservatives versus Labour. And
and now it's Remain versus Leave, so it's almost like Lib Dems versus Conservatives.
So no, I think not really. But we have, things have changed a lot since 2017. You know, we've had the local elections and the European elections where the Lib Dems gained hugely, the Greens gained hugely. Yeah. And people have seen that they don't have to, people are, have not voted for Conservatives and they have not voted for Labour, which they would normally vote for because of their other ideas based on what the those parties are doing. And I think they've had practice at not voting for their parties, so they're quite, they might well not vote for their parties again. Yeah. So it's all up in the air. For me, I, you know, I think I will be voting Green. I'll be voting for myself. But that will be because if I really thought that it would be that I would prevent Brexit by voting for another party, I'd go for it. But the Conservatives do have a large lead. Labour are the second, yes, but they're both losing voters.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's true to say that Labour are the definite people who could overtake the Conservatives. But I think it's still possible to beat the Conservatives. So yeah, in our area, I'm feeling I might as well vote for who I want to vote for.
Well, if you're confirmed standing, I will vote for you.
Thank you, darling.
So we've got that cleared up. But now to the European guidelines. And of course, being in election mode, and that's why I sort of raised the issue, we need to ensure that our democracy is safe and our democratic systems are safe. And of course, this chapter is about that.
I would say that the UK hugely lacks democracy. Our election system is really problematic because we've all seen time and time again that we've had governments
elected
in Britain, our election system, because the first past the post means that people frequently have huge majorities of people, members of parliament, with a minority of votes,
right,
which is completely unfair.
So what you're saying is actually the EU should afford the nation states, the member states, to have democratically informed electoral systems. So first the past the post doesn't fit into
They won't, because it's in there, as we know, we've been doing this stuff on the EU for a long time, and they won't enforce anything on anybody, you know, they won't enforce stuff on members.
Well, they have in certain areas.
Well, they have for the EU, votes for the EU, because that's part of the EU
organisation. No, I mean, in certain areas like minimum wage, like workers' rights, they have enforced certain things, as we know, the Conservatives have been quite against and want to, you know, retract it through the process of Brexit.
But that's to create a level playing field within the EU. Yeah. But they're not in the business of telling people how to run their country, so then they're not going to do that.
I think if we were out, let's say we hadn't been in the European Union for the whole time and now we wanted to get in, I think part of the requirements would be to have proportional representative electoral systems in place and not first past the post. As we know, the European MEP, the parliament elections, there's a premise there that it has to be elected through a proportional system. So you can use, as we know, the Dohon system or any other system, but it has to be proportional.
The way that we've enforced that is not brilliant either. But
I know.
But yes, absolutely, we should.
Yes.
And you're right. So if we went out of the EU and then came back in, I agree with you, they would probably insist that our general elections start being on a proportional
basis. But of course, we've, you know, in our household, we've been on about getting away from the first-past-the-post system for the last 10 years, you know. And of course, we've experienced...
Well, forever, not just the last 10 years.
Okay, 20 years, you know. I know, of course, we've experienced proportional system also in Scotland. When we lived for 10 years in Scotland, we've always started a much better system. But there was no traction down here until the referendum. So now there's debate about our electoral system. And of course, if we do manage to not get the Conservatives in, I think there will be then a momentum to change the way we elect and the way that the parliament works.
Well, there have been debates about it constantly, but the two main parties, the Conservatives and Labour, both benefit from the first past the post hugely at various times in their careers.
But not anymore.
Well,
you know, we know that.
So that is why they'd never consider not having first past the post.
Yeah, but if you take the European elections, for instance, so the Conservatives wouldn't have gotten in at all if it would be first past the post.
Absolutely, yeah.
And of course, you know, we'll see if this general election will shift the power to some of the other parties. You know, that creates an incentive of the former mainstream parties to vote for a change into proportional representation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see. You know, we'll see.
I'm not holding my breath, to be honest. But
yeah, but, you know, we'll not give up the fight in relation to proportional representation.
But that's a big thing that we would like to come out of this election. Yes.
And this chapter then goes on to say our union's democratic system is unique, bringing together directly elected parliamentarians at local, regional, national, and European levels with elected heads of state of government. And for me, that's the essence of this balance that we've always talked about between sovereignty and unity. The sovereignty is that you have the European Council, which is made up of all the leaders of each of the nation states. And then you have the unity, that, you know, which is represented by the parliament, where we have elected MEPs.
Mm-hmm. So we have the EU, and one of the parties that hugely benefited from the way that elections have been done in the EU were UKIP, now the Brexit Party, and Nigel Farage, the leader of the Brexit Party now. But apparently Nigel Farage is being finally disciplined by the EU. You have something about that, Carola?
Yeah, well, I looked into it. And of course, you know, I remembered vaguely that in May and June this year, there were several reports about the expense scandal, the Nigel Farage expense scandal. And then I saw some information that actually that committee, which deals with misconduct, and we talked about that in one of our past episodes, mm-hmm. that there is a advisory committee of the conduct of MEPs that can reprimand and that can suspend MEPs. You know, I saw a tweet that met in the last week. Now, so Nigel Farage's case was on the agenda. I don't know the outcome, and I haven't found anything official yet. So I don't know what that means. But of course, we know that, you know, Britain is actually one of the largest tax havens in the European Union at the moment. And and that's, of course, why the Brexiteers want out, because some of the tax regulations that are coming in are actually detrimental to their interests.
Yeah, which means they'd actually have to pay tax on they have, the wealth they have and the wealth that they're earning.
But I think this chapter is about that. And, we'll, you know, I think we will find that when we go on to the next point. I think the next point that I saw was, you know, on the next column, the bold section, which says, I want citizens to have their say at a conference on the future of Europe to start in 2020 and run for 2 years.
Yep. So all you Conservatives and Brexiteers and Brexiters and people like that, you could have your say.
But actually, it has a forerunner. So now, of course, there's a white paper on the future of Europe. And it is about this new push for European democracy. And how von der Leyen basically has said that this two-yearly conference, citizens shall play, and this is a quote, play a leading and active part. It is a sort of resolve to debate, not to dictate, so to be guided. And there has been European citizens panels even in the last 2 years that have been organized from 2017 to 2019. And it was about 3 steps. You know, there were 2 days where 96 citizens came together. And they were facilitated, and polling experts were there as well. And over these 2 days, they discussed what are the urgent questions that needed to be considered and to be then put out on a questionnaire.
How did they get the 96 citizens?
I don't know. I don't know. I think they just asked for volunteers.
I'm just thinking when Ireland did their stuff on abortion, and they had their, but they had, I think they had a group of 200.
Yeah, but this is not the only thing. So 96... Mm-hmm. Are just
low.
There from, and all the countries were represented. The sad thing is that because we had already triggered Article 50.
Yeah, we weren't there because we said we didn't want to be there.
Yes. But they created a questionnaire in that 2-day process. And that questionnaire was actually then open to all citizens in Europe, including the UK. And I've actually filled out that questionnaire. And let me just tell you about some of the questions. So 13 questions were decided on, and they're quite insightful questions.
Mm-hmm. So were these questions decided by the citizens or the EU or a mixture of both?
These were questions decided by this 2-day process where 96 citizens decided what questions are the key questions to be asked. Okay, so the first one, and I can ask you, is what decisions taken at European Union level would make you prouder of belonging to the Union? Now, you have a choice. Gender equality established everywhere, mm-hmm. increased use of renewable energies, a high level of security, equal wages, a real government for the entire European Union, a minimum level of guaranteed healthcare in all countries of the European Union, increase in organic agriculture, fair and equal access to education for all across Europe, a guaranteed minimum pension, a reduction in food waste.
Wow. Well, are we supposed to just pick one?
Three.
Three. Okay. I didn't realize there were three. So the most important thing, given the way things are, and it doesn't go far enough, but it would be increase
renewable energy.
Because if we don't get renewable energy running everything in 10, 15 years, the planet's over for human beings, really.
Yeah.
So that's the most important thing. You'll have to read out the list again for me to...
Gender.
Yeah.
High level security, equal wages, real government, minimum level of guaranteed healthcare, increase in organic agriculture, fair and equal access to education, guaranteed minimum pension, reduction in food waste.
Education, sort of equal education, and then equal wages. And because I think if we equal wages, that means equal wages for men and women, and that would create the equality between the sexes.
And I think I've chosen only one overlaps, and that is the increased use of renewable energies, and then I have gender. And then I have minimum level of guaranteed healthcare in all countries. Mm-hmm. But so, it's actually quite nice because it gives a sort of understanding of what European citizens want. And of course, when they have the survey went out to all nation states.
And then they can start working towards it.
Exactly. Second question is, to improve each of the following areas, would you prefer to have more or less harmonization between European Union countries? Or would you prefer to keep the current situation? So you have the choice of each of these things, more harmonization, the same, less harmonization. And then it goes into environmental standards, more, the same, or less.
I think each one, it depends what you think, what you imagine is going to happen, because it might mean that if there's more harmonization, it might mean reducing the standards in some countries.
And it's difficult, isn't it? It's boiling down a complexity into something very simple.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So more, I think.
Yeah. And I think there are loads of things. There's education, animal welfare, quality of goods and services.
Right.
So it goes through that. The third question is, on immigration in Europe, what should now be prioritized for the benefit of Europeans in 20 years' time?
Mm-hmm.
And the choices are, and again, one can choose three, improve the situation in the years. You've got a choice there again. 12, regarding the future of agriculture, fishery and food production in Europe, what are the main actions that the EU should prioritize? And then is there anything else you would like to add to express your concerns, hopes?
Wow, that sounds... Are we going to put that on our website?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, for
Thank
people
you.
To...
Brawler always does all that stuff. Fantastic.
So I think those are the initiatives which demonstrate that there's a real drive to increase the voice, the collective voice in the democratic process.
Again, far more than the UK does that. That we just get told what the people want by the government constantly, which never chimes really with what I want or what a load of people I know want.
Yeah. And I would have loved to be one of the 96
seems to be,
people working
oh,
that
yeah,
out.
Oh, yeah, that would have been great. But it seems our government at present seems to only think about what very wealthy people in the UK want rather than anything else.
Yeah. Then the next section is headed with special relationship with the European Parliament.
Yeah, I want to strengthen the partnership between the European Commission and the European Parliament. I believe we should give a stronger role to the voice of the people, the European Parliament, in initiating legislation. They ought to have highlighted that, perhaps. I support a right of initiative for the European Parliament.
Yes.
So we take that to mean, she goes on further, actually, to talk about that a little bit
more.
Yeah,
but does it mean that this initiation of legislation, did that not work before? How did that work before?
Well, as it worked before, it was only the European Commission could make the laws.
Right.
And then they had to be ratified by the European Parliament. So the European Parliament could say, no, that's not a good law. We're not going to have that. Or they could alter it, but they couldn't initiate it. So I think this is what she's saying, that Parliament is going to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So she says that she'll ensure that her commissioners brief the European Parliament at all stages of all international negotiations, following the mould set by the Brexit negotiations. And that there will be more appearances in committee meetings and commissioner presence in discussions between the European Parliament and the Council.
And it's called, she mentions there, trilogue discussions.
Yeah.
So that's Parliament, the Council, and which is the third?
Third is the
Commission.
Commission.
Yeah.
Yeah. Commission, and I think, being the sort of civil service of the European Union.
Yeah. And that's, again, you know, as we always said, the European Union is also a project in development. You know, that will certainly strengthen the ability to work as a bloc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that means in terms of the, you know, at the moment, we you know, you mentioned the example of new member states who wanted to join, who met all the requirements, and then the council not being able to ratify it because individuals vetoed certain
individual
decisions.
Countries.
Individual countries or leaders of the countries were vetoing those decisions. And I think, you know, that sort of blockage is also something that has to be resolved.
And I think that's the intention. In that the European Union is working more towards qualified majorities rather than vetoes.
Yeah.
And it entirely makes sense because it's really difficult. Certainly the right wing in this country would always talk about how rule by committee is effectively no rule at all or doing nothing because committees never get anything done.
But they do.
But they do, yes, exactly. And all the best decisions normally are taken by committees. They don't take necessarily very fast decisions. Yeah.
Just on a personal note, a very, very good friend from my university days had a good piece of advice for me at some point. And she just simply said, if you can't make a decision, you need more information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's as simple as that a committee brings a lot of information and a lot of expertise to the table to make an informed decision. And of course, what we've seen in the UK, you know, some of the daft decisions that we've made is because there is suddenly a culture where you don't listen to the experts, you don't have any, you know, we talked about the Quengos before, you know, you don't have enough independent bodies that can be trusted to provide the evidence to make informed decisions. And suddenly you've got loads of lobbying groups that pretend to be experts that push decision-making into a certain area.
Well, I think it started off that way. Now it's gone to the point of you don't bother asking anybody.
Yeah.
You just, you know, if you're the minister for something, you make that decision and get on with it. And whether you know anything about it or not, maybe you made minister 3 months ago, you just make that decision.
Yeah.
And that seems ludicrous.
Yeah, and of course, you know,
it's proven to be ludicrous in many instances as well.
As we said before, the civil service is such a key element in having that long-standing experience and expertise in creating continuity, you know, and I'm just reminded again, you know, I've heard a podcast how there is now this problematic situation in the US where the civil service, you know, most of the, you know, the large part of the civil service has just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And because for various reasons, and that creates a situation where if the next president comes into place, they need to start almost again from scratch because they don't have that continuity because the civil service has been so
cut down.
And you know, I think we're not quite as bad, but it's,
oh, we are definitely,
yeah, possibly,
you know, it seemed crazy that the Conservatives came into power in 2016 as the Conservative government, and they started saying, well, we're going to do Brexit, we're going to get it done, we're going to get it done quickly. And all the time they were going to get it done quickly, bearing in mind that we had like 900 laws that needed to be passed before we could Brexit, they cut civil servants still. Uh-huh. And they were still cutting them. They'd cut them since 2009, 2010, and they were still cutting them. And yet they were requiring tons of more work to be done for Brexit. It was right from the start, it was going to be a disaster.
Yeah, right. And of course, as part of this process of enhancing the special relationship with the European Parliament, this is what this section is called, and having this trilogue discussion between the Council, the Parliament and the Commission, she also suggests I will be happy to revive the tradition of a question hour. And I did look that up. And of course, I got reminded, and you probably know that the tradition of a question hour comes actually from the Westminster Parliament, you know, the oldest, the mother of parliaments.
Don't call it that, though. I hate this whole idea. I think we're the great-great-grandmother of parliaments, and we look like it, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, we're duddering around, we don't know what we're doing, we're half blind, we don't listen because we've left our hearing aids out and we can't walk anywhere anymore.
Yeah, but do you believe in this tool of the question hour? Let me tell you a bit more about that.
Okay, go ahead. So I think in the European Union, I'm sure it would be really good. Yeah. In the Westminster Parliament, it's just this battle every week.
Adversarial battle.
Yeah, which is a bit stupid.
And in the European Union, you know, she says revive. And I just thought, okay, so they didn't have a question hour for some time. But when I was looking into it, so from 2009 to 2014, I believe, they had the then president of the European Commission set up a sort of question hour. And within that, each hour has a sort of horizontal theme. And the questioner has 1 minute to post their questions. And then it's being answered by either the president or some of the commissioners. And the answers can last up to 2 minutes.
Right.
So it's quite a tight turnaround, and it gives opportunities to really scrutinize certain decision-making, you know, processes or certain decisions that have been made. Mm. So it sounds like a good thing. Now, of course, you know, I have a feeling there's a gap. I couldn't quite understand, did they stop in 2014? I couldn't find into that, but it stopped at some point. And of course, Ursula von der Leyen has now said, you know, we can resurrect that, and, you know, maybe it's going to look like that.
And I think in that way of doing it, it's good because you can raise concerns, you can raise just queries. It shouldn't be about point scoring. It should be about gaining more information. And presumably the way that the EU are doing it, you know, that you can have the 2 minute answer in the chamber, but they could also have, and further information is on this website or whatever, so that people can look it up.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it's all being filmed as well, and you can look up all of the individual sessions, you know.
Whereas
just like
in Britain, it's just a yaboo, you're rubbish, we're better than you are, oh, don't know what you're talking about, that's blah, blah. And nobody's any the wiser, and we've just wasted a day of Parliament to do nothing other than kind of clashing heads and point scoring between the government and the opposition.
Meet, you know, the content, you know, it's quite often about process and this.
Yeah,
country.
And you don't learn anything from it half the time.
Yeah, having said that, because, you know, as we know, there are more people than ever watching the parliamentary TV channel, and I've watched some parliamentary debates and question hours as well. And yes, there are the prime minister's questions, which are the, you know, the big stage where they just want to be seen to make a statement, and we hear the same statements over and over again. But there are, of course, you know, other topics, and you realize that within the other topics where it's not such a partisan culture, they really get into the nitty-gritty and they really ask questions about details in relation to certain things. And then the government says, yes, we'll look into that. And that's a good point, and we'll see what we can do with that.
So that's the sort of stuff that's just ongoing daily business, which is what ought to be happening. But
yeah, and I have a feeling, and of course, you know, I also sometimes feel I don't know enough about the parliament. And of course, what we see is just what happens in that House of Commons chamber. And we don't see, or we don't make the effort to go to, for instance, the video feed of the committees, of what is being done in the committee work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
and,
true.
You know, that happens, of course, in smaller groups. There's not as much grandstanding there. And I've only watched some of the feeds in relation to very, very specific inquiries, but not in general in terms of the committee work. And I'm not even sure, you know, but I might be wrong with that. You know, I'm not even sure if all of them are able to be seen live or recorded. You know, I don't know if that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me either.
Right. And then it, of course, makes the point in this section that, you know, Europe needs to move towards full co-decision power for the European Parliament and away from unanimity for climate, energy, unanimity for climate, energy, social and taxation policies. So she maps out in which area. She doesn't actually mention explicitly the Council, but she does say the Union must use the full potential set out in the treaties. We need to move towards a full co-decision power for the European Parliament and away from unanimity. But the unanimity must refer specifically to the Council.
Yeah. So it's basically taking away the veto for things to do with climate, to do with energy, to do with social and taxation policies.
Yeah. And of course, the one big...
And that's one, the big one there for Brexit being taxation policies, I think.
Yes. But of course, the big one which is missing here is migration.
Mm-hmm.
And, and of course, we know...
Might come under social, I'm not sure. But
yeah, I doubt it because it's such a hot topic. And I think that's maybe an indication that she treads softly there. And of course, we know that, you know, migration has been a really big thing. And, you know, when you look at the history of the European Union or the member states, how they dealt with some of the migration issues, you know, Hungary right back in 2016 built a razor via Beria, and that then created migrant problems in Greece because they were stranded there. And the European Union has a rule, which is in the Dublin regulation, where refugees are required to claim asylum to where they first arrive.
Yeah, which is terrible, I think.
But of course, that also means once they're in, so certain countries that were so stretched, like Greece, Italy and Croatia, have actually been allowing migrants to pass through.
Yeah.
And because, of course, once they're in, then we have a free Schengen area. So, you know, they can just roam in the free Schengen area without being tracked or without being, you know, noted. You know, tracked is maybe the wrong word. But when I was looking into that, and of course, that's the big thing, is that, you know, there are real big differences. Germany, of course, in 2015 had the highest amount of migration, took the highest number of migrants. 1.5 million in 2015. And of course, then Germany was very critical of UK's stance and France's stance for very meager commitments. And that's the word of Merkel, meager commitments to take people in.
Mm-hmm.
But there were vetoes in relation to progressing plans in relation to relocation of migrants across the whole continent. So they have attempted to put something in place. But, you know, Czech Republic, Slovakia and Hungary were actually vetoing those developments as well.
Yeah. I was quite amazed by some of the, you know, that places like Lebanon took 1.2 million refugees from Syria. So the Lebanon now has a quarter of its population are refugees from Syria.
Yeah.
A quarter of its population. Because we are not doing our bit in Europe of taking those people in. The worst equipped, really, in terms of their own position to take people in, they're taking people in.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, because we're so wealthy and we've got so much, we're like, oh no, if other people came in, we'd have to share that with them.
I know.
We don't want to do that. We're not going to let people in. Whereas the Lebanon, like, we've got nothing anyway. So come on in and share our nothing.
Yeah. I've got a figure for that. So worldwide, the developing countries are hosting the largest share of refugees. So 86% of worldwide refugees are hosted by developing countries.
Yeah.
And then actually the least developed countries, so in that category of least developed, they alone are hosting 25% of the world's refugees.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible. But, you know,
and we don't feel capable of doing that in the UK,
yes,
for example.
And of course, almost the only solution, and of course, that creates additional tensions. The only solution for us in the EU was to pay Turkey 3 billion euros to help with hosting Syrian migrants.
Yeah.
So, of course, Turkey, you know, as I said before, so Germany in 2015 had the highest EU, as in the EU, the highest intake of migrants, 1.5 million. But Turkey in that year had 2.7 million.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that creates tensions then as well. It's not mentioned here in this paragraph. And I can imagine that rather than putting it in, which creates a lot of tensions and debate, you know, you just don't mention it. And
just in reference to what you said about Germany taking in 1.5 million in 2015, what I looked at the largest increase in populations due to migration. And the country with the biggest increase in population due to migration, apparently in Europe, is Luxembourg, followed by Cyprus, Malta, Spain, Austria, Sweden, Ireland, Belgium, and then Germany.
Yes, UK.
UK wasn't on the list. You know, we've taken in virtually no migrants.
But of course, you know, it is a hot topic. And just, you know, taking Germany as an example, you know, I know that in 2018, the sort of coalition between the CSU and the CDU almost fell because the CSU wanted harder border rules. And Merkel from the CDU actually said, no, we need a sort of unilateral EU solution and not a specific German solution. And of course, you know, again, you suddenly see the tension between unity and sovereignty and the needs of that. But I think what hopefully will happen now is that there's an understanding that what the EU can do is afford the member states to put out campaigns to foster more positive sort of images and positive, understanding of what migrants can do for us as part of our society.
I think we should just be welcoming them in.
Yeah. And it moves on to talking about the lead candidate system, so the you know, the Spitzenkandidaten system.
Yeah, which I struggled with a bit, I have to admit.
Well, I found this fabulous article from Politico, which puts it into a sort of crime story. Who killed the Spitzenkandidat system?
Mm-hmm.
And I can go through all of the sort of culprits, or what do you say? The
But before you do,
yeah.
I just want to put it into a context of the UK, because this is largely a sort of UK broadcast. And if you think of Theresa May, who has been one of the least popular leaders in Britain, but she was the chosen candidate. She was the lead, the Spitzenkandidaten, if you like, from the Conservative Party to be the Prime Minister. But if you ask the public if they wanted her to be the Prime Minister, not so much. You know, they because some people wanted the Conservatives to win in the 2017 election, they got just less than half the vote. Or, sorry, they got just less than half the MPs, but they got a lot less than half the vote. So is that democratic? I think not. If we bear that in mind as we think about the Spitzenkandidaten and how they get selected and whether they are selected or not, I think that that really comes to bear on Weber, who
Manfred Weber,
who was supposed to be the Spitzenkandidat from EPP.
And of course, you know, it's quite a complex issue yet again. But of course, what they wanted to move away with is the perception that there's backroom dealings that nobody has an insight into, specifically as part of the council, that makes decisions that nobody else has an insight into. So that's the thing that they want to move away from. And of course, with the Spitzenkandidat system, there was a suggestion that at the time when the European election campaigning starts, you would know when you vote for a party who the lead candidate actually is. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, similar to, you know, to our system, that
except
when you go to general elections,
well,
if you go to the general elections, you know who the lead candidate is. It was Theresa May, except, of course, you know, now with Boris Johnson, you know, Theresa May is gone and suddenly we've got somebody else.
Although now, again, we're back to the, we know it's Boris Johnson. So
yes, exactly.
For the Conservatives.
But in terms of who murdered, it's like a murder mystery, this article from Politico, who murdered the Spitzenkandidat system. And I'll just go to the solution. It's everyone. So who killed the Spitzenkandidat system? So it starts off with, it's a crime story that's also a political drama played out over multiple summits, including a day and night marathon.
Shakespeare would have had a field
about
day.
How the European Union should be governed. Absolutely. Shakespeare would have had a, say it again.
A field day.
Okay, so first of all, the parliament is guilty because it was unclear about the process and details of the system. So some MPs insisted it should work as last time. Others argued that the system could, that the Spitzenkandidat could be elected by a majority of votes in the European Parliament. And so it left open the possibility that different parties could band together behind one Spitzenkandidat. So it's again this notion of, yes, you have maybe a majority party. Should that person be the leader? Or is it that you can create a majority by alliances? And that is
which
the
seems to make a lot of sense.
Yes. And again, you know, there was, because it's not in any of the treaties.
Because it's not actually written down.
The second entity that killed the system is the German language. Choosing a long German word, and I quote here, admittedly not so long by German standards, to describe something and expecting it to be easily understood and liked across Europe was probably über-optimistic.
It's okay. Not that hard to understand, though.
Spitzenkandidaten
it gets system. Explained in, rather than just mocked or something like that, which it probably did in British papers.
Third is the EPP. In picking Weber, the EPP increased the chances that EU leaders would reject their candidate as unqualified to run the EU executive. Because, of course, the EPP, the European People's Party, took a big risk in choosing Weber, because he had no experience of a senior executive public office. He was never a leader of a country.
Yes.
So in picking Weber rather than the former Finnish Prime Minister Alexander Stubb, the EPP increased the chances that EU leaders would reject their candidate as unqualified to run the EU executive and choose a non-Spitzenkandidat.
Yeah.
So previously, of course, it's always been a head of a national government or a former head of a national government or senior ministers. And in choosing Weber, that broke that sort of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And in nominating Weber,
and
the
that
EPP...
that is a huge thing.
It is a huge thing for the Commission. Because
yeah, you don't want the person running the whole of Europe to be somebody who's inexperienced.
Yeah, but also, not for the Commission, for the Council, which is made up of all the leaders of the nation states.
They're picking somebody beneath them, effectively.
You want somebody who's got the experience of running a country.
Yeah.
And in nominating Weber, the EPP also ignored a tradition that the Commission chief should be able to speak French, a move that was sure to go down badly with Peers.
So it sounds like they were trying to sabotage the whole thing anyway.
Well, I think there was, again, this German-French tension. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as somebody living in the UK, you know, that people might not be aware, but of course, between Germany and France, there have been traditionally...
A little bit of antagonism. Yes, a bit exactly. Like the England-France antagonism.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Okay, so the third potential murderer of the system, Guy Verhofstadt and Europe's ALDE alliance. So Verhofstadt, who was, of course, until you know recently the leader of the Liberal group in the European Parliament, was initially an enthusiastic backer of the system. But as they moved towards a tie-up with Macron, who was a critic of the system, Verhofstadt changed tack. And so the Belgium, so he was the Belgian, former Belgian prime minister, and he justified the U-turn by saying that he'd hoped that transnational lists of candidates would feature in the election, allowing voters to choose the Spitzenkandidat directly. And of course, that is a sort of system that you have a separate election process for a leader. And why that was also problematic was that current political leaders couldn't then become the leader because they can't take away to campaign. So if you have a separate system, then the campaigning process would mean that they just can't take part of that.
Right.
And of course, then moving away from sort of a Spitzenkandidaten system to a sort of list system, a transnational list, the ALDE alliance was not supporting the Spitzenkandidaten system anymore.
Right. Okay.
Next prospective person who killed off the system, Macron. And of course, Macron, as a newcomer on the EU stage, who does not belong to either the main centre-right or centre-left families, Macron made no secret of his disdain for the Spitzenkandidat system. Okay, so for him, it didn't have any advantages. And for the system to make sense, according to Macron, the EU should have introduced transnational lists of candidates. So that's, of course, you know, again, supporting the transnational lists. But he also thought that Weber wasn't really up to the job. But with that critique, he weakened the system. Viktor Orbán, of course, is another person who chipped in. He claimed credit for killing two Spitzenkandidaten, Weber and Timmermans. So he initially supported Weber until the end, in quotes. But his U-turn came only after the Germans, who have long sought to cultivate good relations with Orbán, supported his party, so Orbán's party, suspension from the EPP. In case of Weber, they were helped by Macron, plus socialists and liberal leaders. With Timmermans, they were assisted by the EPP prime ministers. So there were sort of different alliances that were then against the Spitzenkandidaten system because Weber and Timmermans had issues with these two right. sort of constellations. EPP prime ministers. So a group of national leaders from the EPP, including Ireland's Leo Varadkar, Bulgaria's Borisov, and Croatia's Plenković, rebelled against a compromise plan championed by Merkel, which would have given Timmermans the commission presidency and Weber the president of the parliament. So that would have retained the Spitzenkandidaten system because those would then have the job. But these individuals couldn't compromise on that. So they decided they wanted the EPP to hold on to the commission presidency above all. So they just wanted EPP to be, you know, to have the presidency.
All right. Yeah, and they didn't care who got it, as long as it was somebody from the EPP.
Exactly. And that then meant, because there were vetoes in the other way around, you suddenly couldn't have the Spitzenkandidaten system anymore. So the vast majority of EPP prime ministers don't believe that we should give up the presidency of the commission quite so easily without a fight, Varadkar declared. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that created additional difficulties. Yes. And then Weber is next on this list. He was, of course, the Spitzenkandidat of the party that finished first in the European Parliament election, albeit with fewer seats than last time. So there was a loss of seats. Mm-hmm. But Weber could not persuade other pro-EU parties in the parliament to rally behind him. If he had been able to demonstrate he commanded a majority, it would have been much harder for the EU leaders to reject him.
Yeah.
So there's a lack of persuasive power. And then MEPs from EPP. So after an all-night session, some EU leaders some EU leaders were still trying on Monday afternoon to pursue a package that would have made Timmermans commission president. But then came word from a meeting of EPP MEPs in Strasbourg that they would not vote to confirm any nominee who did not come from their party family.
Right.
So even MEP said EPP got the majority, the presidency should be
Yeah.
From EPP.
So they're going with the democraticness of it.
And then the last person guilty, all Spitzenkandidaten and MEPs. Weber was not the only candidate who couldn't put together a majority in parliament, nor could Timmermans or competition commissioner Margaret Vestager, who emerged as the Liberals' choice for the commission. And MEPs from the main pro-EU groups were not willing to make the compromises necessary to establish such a majority. That handed the whip hand to national leaders, so to the council, to pick someone else, resulting in the surprise choice of von der Leyen. So who killed the Spitzenkandidat? It's an outcome familiar to fans of Poirot. All of them did. And of course, this is an article, just to quote the article, because it was just a lovely find. Who killed the Spitzenkandidat system from Andrew Gray, Jacopo Barigazzi, and Maya de la Baume on the 2nd of May 2019 on Politico.
Are you going to put a link to that on?
Yes, I will. So because we sort of discussed, so what happened?
Mm.
And you can tell that, you know, first of all, it's a complexity of also the relationships between the rules that the commission set up, but the council and the parliament, and then the different sort of power machinations and negotiations that happen between them and within them.
And it does make sense. There's no point in having a leader that generally people don't want. So
And I find it actually, you know, if you think about it, you know, nothing has been written down, nothing has been put on paper in a treaty. That means that we got a commission together and a commission president is actually quite extraordinary. You know, I think it's actually quite a success that they managed to.
Well, yes. I think a lot of people feel I want something written down which is properly a proper process and properly understood. You know, the Greens, for example, did really well in the EU elections, and there's not somebody representing the Greens on the top five jobs at all.
Yeah.
And that seems wrong to me. To me, it seems like, well, it should be the Spitzenkandidaten from one and from the other and from the other and from the other. So, you know, the top five people get the top five jobs unless, you know, the people getting the most votes are getting so many more than the fifth grouping or something like that. So it would be good if it was thought about a little bit more.
But of course, that's what Ursula von der Leyen has promised, that they will put something forward.
Yeah. Which does make a lot of sense. It's like, yeah, we'll think about it. We like the Spitzenkandidat. So the next section is more transparency and scrutiny in the European Parliament, or the EU rather. And what does that mean? So as far as I could tell, there is a transparency register. So it's basically if people who want to lobby, we get to find out, or there is a register which tells anybody who wants to know who's been meeting with whom so that you can find out. Who's been lobbying.
I think that's part of a whole notion of transparency scrutiny. And in that little section, you know, that there are three paragraphs in there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she suggests I will support the creation of an independent ethics body common to all EU institutions. And she also suggests that she believes we need more transparency throughout the legislative process. And I also looked into it and I found actually a document which was penned in March 2019, so just before the European election, but it's headed Transparency, Integrity and Accountability in the EU Institutions. And it's, you know, 10, 11 pages long, and it goes into the EU constitutional framework in relation to transparency, integrity and accountability. So it does mention, the sort of constitutional foundations in the EU treaties and how it relates to good governance and how to build trust. There's a section on current rules and tools ensuring transparency, integrity and accountability. So this notion of disclosing information on interactions with lobbyists, the transparency register from which you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a section on integrity and standards of conduct. And of course, we heard about in the European Parliament that there is a committee that deals just with the conduct of MEPs. It also has a section on access to documents and transparency of the legislative process. And then a third big section is about recent initiatives and reforms to increase transparency, integrity, and accountability. Then there are new transparency tools. Mm-hmm. So there should be a legislative footprint, as they mention. And then a section.
What does that mean? legislative footprint?
I think, for instance, that, well, from this document, for instance, it suggests, well, I think it's like that things are videoed and you can see them, that the documents, all the minutes are available for the public. But in this section, it says, for instance, following the Bureau's decision in 2016 to request its administration to develop a template for MEPs to produce a voluntary legislative footprint, setting out which interest representatives they have consulted, Parliament called on rapporteurs, shadow rapporteurs and committee chairs to use this tool regarding files under their responsibility.
So it's a bit like the register, but for historical record in a way.
Yeah. And I think it's just documentation of the processes that are part of the legislative procedures.
Right.
Parliament further raised concerns over the quotation mark revolving doors phenomena, which refers to the movement of politicians, decision makers and officials between the public and the private sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I assume there's sort of some experience that the lobbyists came from, you know, basically insiders. You know, I don't know how I would interpret that.
I think it's when somebody comes out of government, whether it be a national government or an EU government or whatever, but they come from government and then they go straight into a big job in an oil company or something. And then it probably means they've been favouring that oil company in the last couple of years or so.
There was a revolving door, you know, if they then became a lobbyist in relation to their new interest.
Well, yeah, I think there's not a problem with them being a lobbyist and using their knowledge, but there is a problem if they have done it, you know, if they've had that in the back of their mind and it's a bit quid pro quo. They've got that job because of what they've been doing when they were a minister.
We don't know for sure. We're thinking.
No, but that's clearly what could happen, which is why if it has to be 3 years before you get the job, then people are less likely to do it.
Then there's a little paragraph on effective whistleblower protection.
Oh, good.
Which, of course, is
it's very difficult.
Mm. You know, very current at the moment, considering what's going on in the US. And then a last section is on the reform of the Code of Conduct of Commissioners and political parties funding. So within the political parties funding, in order to increase visibility, transparency and accountability of European political parties and their affiliated political foundations, Parliament and the Council adopted on 22nd October 2014 a regulation on the statute and funding of European political parties and European political foundations. So it just shows that, you know, this goes back, this document a bit, but so this was updated 2019, March 2019. But you can see that some of the transparency rules go back a few years. And I think that is, you know, part of the effort in understanding that there is an accountability to citizens of the European Union. And in order for that to happen, there needs to be transparency. So, you know, these rules are about ensuring that there's sufficient scrutiny and transparency and access to the documentation.
Mm.
Because, of course, the European Union is there for all of us.
Yeah, hopefully.
So that's transparency and scrutiny. And then, of course, the biggie is in the next three paragraphs, which are headed protecting our democracy.
Yes. Shall I read out that first paragraph?
Yes, please.
Our democratic systems and institutions have come increasingly under attack in recent years from those who wish to divide and destabilize our union. We need to do more to protect ourselves from external interference. Absolutely. So that's hacking by Russians or Chinese or anybody else who happens to be out there wanting to break into various things.
Yeah.
Digital platforms are actors of progress for people, societies and economies. To preserve this progress, we need to ensure that they are not used to destabilize our democracies, which they have definitely been being used for. We should develop a joint approach and common standards to tackle issues such as disinformation and online hate messages. And that's really, really important.
Well, as we said, you know, Twitter has just simply stopped any kind of political advertisement. And I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. And I don't know what the other online media things are like, but clearly Facebook is out and out the worst because it's everywhere. Most people have got a Facebook account.
And, you know, to a certain extent, I do think that the words have a real meaning here. I think there's a sort of drive from the European Union, more so than from our current government in the UK,
absolutely,
to really understand the threats that come from disinformation. And of course, she says, I will put forward a European Democracy Action Plan, which will address the threats of external interventions in our European elections. And it will include legislative proposals to ensure greater transparency on paid political advertising and clearer rules on the financing of European political parties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was actually looking that up and found, for instance, that there's a flagship project of the European External Action Service that specifically looks at creating an understanding for all governments of what disinformation can do or what kind of interference, electoral interference they are. And I will put the link up there, but it sort of outlines for anybody to read what are the methods of foreign electoral interference. And for instance, there's a section which goes into 10 methods of potential electoral interference. And each of these methods, you can actually see then in that information page what the case references are. So for
instance, run through the 10, just the titles?
So one is disinformation. So the class of method is information manipulation. So it has a definition, it has an objective, and then it has case references. So there's evidence that it was used in the 2014 Ukrainian elections, 2016 Dutch referendum, 2016 Brexit referendum, 2016 US elections, 2017 Catalan independence referendum, 2017 German elections, and it has links to each of those where the evidence is found. So disinformation is one of those 10. Political advertising is another one. Mm-hmm. The 2016 Brexit referendum features there again. Third, sentiment amplification. So it's again information manipulation, but the use of fake accounts, trolls, and or automated bots on social media and other online fora. You know, so we know very much about
that. We know
that's
been happening here.
And again, Brexit referendum is one of them, the US elections, Catalan independence vote, so 2017 German elections. And again, the links are there for the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Then four, identity falsification. Five, hack and leak operations. So the theft of emails or documents through hacking or phishing operations, followed by their strategic public release. Reconnaissance hacking is number six. Then seven, infrastructure attacks. Number eight, elite co-optation. So class of method is grooming, the cultivation of favorable relationships with key public and private sector elites. Number nine, party or campaign financing.
Yeah, and once again, both the Brexit Party and before them and UKIP both have bad funding discipline.
Yeah. And then the last method, number 10, extreme intervention. So the use of hard power to intervene in a country's political developments and democratic process, typically via overt or covert military action, cushioned within a broader hybrid framework that violates the target's country's territorial sovereignty. And of course, you know, we've got
that happened to Ukraine.
Georgia, Ukraine, Montenegro in 2016.
Wow, that's really interesting.
And, you know, and that's the website EU versus disinfo at EU. But I will put a link in the show notes.
Super.
But, you know, for anybody interested and of course, you know, in the upcoming election, we really need to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, some, you know, the government needs to be aware of and fighting it at the time, but we haven't put anything in place to do that. So we're less able to do it than we were in 2017 or before that in 2016.
And then it concludes.
Yes. So finally, she says, this is her vision for a Europe that strives for more. She will fight for the ideas that she presents and always try to seek as wide a consensus as she can for them. She'll work as closely as possible with the European Parliament and the Council. The political guidelines that she presents, along with the work done by the other institutions, will form the basis for the first ever multi-annual programme, which should be agreed by the three institutions later on this year.
Yeah. And she sets out in the next paragraph some almost immediate goals or some timed goals. They are suddenly, you know, gender equal team in the first 100 days, Green Deal, 2020, a conference, 2024, the border security in the 10,000 European border and coast guards, and 2050 climate neutrality. So it feels like chuck, chuck, chuck. Those are five targets that she will have to hit, and they're all in this last paragraph.
But one big thing that we ought to realise is that 2050 is a bit late for us to be climate neutral. Since we're likely to be the first climate neutral continent, and we were told by the IPCC that we've got 10 years to sort it out, i.e. by around about 2030, leaving it until 2050 is way, way, way too late. So, but at least we could get started, I suppose, and then maybe we can go for really big on it next European election.
And of course, it's heartbreaking to hear the news of the Californian wildfires and how it affects individuals. And at the same time, here we had, again, flooding, this time possibly not historic, but quite severe flooding, which, you know, affected also a lot of people. And it's, you know, it does feel like a disaster movie a bit.
Well, constantly it's just disaster movie wherever you look in the world. Mm. And that's now, you know, as next year, it'll be worse because there'll be more carbon in the atmosphere. The year after, it'll be worse still. And it's just going to get worse and worse.
So we got to turn this around.
Yeah.
Fast.
Yes, as fast as we possibly can.
Right. So that was the political guidelines.
Okay.
Wow. We finished this.
Yeah, we're celebrating now. We're going to go downstairs, crack open the champagne.
And I think next time, we've already decided what we're going to do next time. Next time, we're going to do something.
Right. I can't remember what we decided. What was it?
We're going to look at something.
We deciding really means Carola's deciding.
No. We've decided together. You're going to remember in a second when I'm going to say that. So we're going to look at different EU apps.
Mm.
Apps on your phone, smartphone.
We did decide that. Yeah, that was good.
Good. Android.
And we're going to do it in a very easy way because Carola's looked at most of these already, of course. And I haven't. So she's going to be showing them to me and I'll be responding to them.
And we're going to have a lot of fun just playing around with them. There are some games there. There are some more serious stuff. There's...
And I'll try to respond because I'm not very much of a responsive person, as you've probably noticed, anybody listening to these. But I'll try and be ultra responsive as we go through it. Get a lot of sleep.
That's right. Right. So if you enjoyed the show, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. Feel free to follow us on Twitter. We have a Twitter feed on @DitheringE. Goodbye for now and have a fabulous week.
Bye.
I haven't heard your voice for 6 weeks like this. I have heard it only through high pass filter through the phone. Say something nice so I can melt again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice. Mm. Right.
It's horrible that they do sound better than they do in real life.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's like we have to talk to each other all the time with microphones and headphones on.
Can we take the microphones into bed?
Exactly, yeah, maybe.